feel like it's alive and well in Appalachia today. We're going through a period where people are really like starting to own their like hillbilliness, reclaiming the music and being like, this isn't some like antiquated thing. This is like fresh and new and relevant as ever. The tradition is happening.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, to Harvard Square, as we celebrate the musical roots and history of a unique region of America, Appalachia. Tonight's presentation is a special co-production with the Revels organization and will feature performances by two amazing musicians, Jake Blunt and Libby Whitenauer, also known as Tui. In addition, we will meet Revels creative directors, Patty Swanson and Megan Henderson, who will help us understand the ethno-musical discovery and appreciation of the music we'll hear. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and I have to admit to having an immense weakness for Appalachian music because it sings to the soul. Historically, the Appalachian Mountains south of the Mason-Dixon line have produced a creative crucible for the fusion of several musical forms. There, Native American, African American, and European traditions crossed paths and cross-pollinated to create a uniquely rich cultural sound. The songs of the region have been passed down from generation to generation, and they celebrate not only the quiet beauty of the mountains, but also the fire and passion of real lives, lived filled with hardship and struggle, and capturing the light and darkness of human relationships. Well, I'm not going to waste any more time talking. I know you came to hear the music. So I'm handing you over to Patty Swanson, the very knowledgeable artistic director for the Revels. Welcome, Paddy.
First, a bit about Revels. Revels, we're actually approaching our 50th year of existence, and we're approaching the 100th birthday of our founder, who's John Langstaff. So it was founded in 1971. John Langstaff, or Jack, as we called him, was a concert baritone, had a career that was quite extraordinary. He was born in Brooklyn Heights. As a boy, he was a boy soprano at Grace Church. And his parents were great music lovers and great party givers. And it's quite likely that the birth of the Christmas Revels, that idea of celebration, really came out of the carol parties that his parents had in Brooklyn Heights around the fireplace with his mother playing the piano. About 1935, when Jack was around 15 and his time as a boy soprano was over, his voice had just broken, his teacher at his New York school and his mentor persuaded his parents that she'd like to take him on a little trip to the mountains, and she took Jack to the White Top Festival in Marion, Virginia. Now, the White Top Festival didn't exist for very long. I didn't realize that, but it was a fairly short period, and it was almost exclusively Appalachian music. Jack had really had a great sort of musical education, but his sort of interaction with folk music or traditional music was almost zero. And this was an eye-opener. What he said was he met a whole bunch of people, but the most interesting thing were the aged Appalachian singers. His quote was, "At first, I could not imagine that someone with an old cracked voice could get up in front of people and sing like that. But by the second or the third verse, I was hooked." And Jack's admiration for that music led sort of indirectly into five American Appalachian Christmas Revels that were based on music that sort of had its origins there. So Revels, we like to think of it as a sort of framework, a frame that you could put around experiencing a culture. So each year, we take a culture or a time period, and we do a reasonably deep dive with about 50 or 60 people, that's adults and children, and over a period of about three and a half months or so, we kind of steep them in the culture. And that is by stories, by songs, by little snippets of information. But mostly we rely on information that either we've gathered over the years or comes directly from what we call tradition bearers. And that concept of a tradition bearer is somebody that we can rely on as a guide, somebody who can open the door to a particular culture. It's not always, you know, it may be a very subjective view of the culture, it has to be, but we look for an authentic note somewhere in the revels. And over the years, we've done a lot of different versions of that. You know, when we did Georgia Sea Island music, we had Bessie Jones. Occasionally we do Native American material. We had Leon Joseph Littlebird, who is a Native American. For gospel, we you know, Janice Allen or the Silverleaf Singers. For Arabic material, we had Karim Nagy. Dmitry Pokrovsky in 1990 came over with his entire troupe the same year that the wall came down. And we had an American-Russian revels. And we discovered that the Russians do mummers plays that are scatological and wonderful, and we did them side by side. And that the Russians love to sing shape note music. Very briefly, the background to the Appalachian story is that in England, the Industrial Revolution kind of wiped out a lot of the folk songs that were passed on through oral tradition. They were kind of drying up. And then this woman, Olive Dame Campbell, who was the wife of a government official, was traveling through Appalachia and actually started to take note of some songs that she recognized. One in particular, Barbary Allen, that is a ballad from, you know, that has origins in Welsh and Scottish going back to the 1700s. And that sort of led to this kind of interest that Cecil Sharp picked up on, and he came over with Maud Carpellis, and we had this phenomenon of the song catchers, people going around with recording devices and kind of taking these ballads that were kind of lost to the British, but had been preserved in Appalachia. Now, you're going to learn from Jake all the things that those people did not pick up, and there were a lot. There's a whole other story, which is quite fascinating. And so we're looking forward to doing that. That's pretty much all I want to set this up as. Our sixth version of the Appalachian Revels is we have these two who are musicians this year, are part of our musicians, and Libby, I know, comes from
Tennessee.
Yeah, right. I couldn't hear you.
East Tennessee.
Right. Okay. So right in the area there, and we have a whole sort of line, a thread to follow there through the music. So, without further ado, I'm going to pass you on to our music director, Megan Henderson, who'll tell you a little bit about the music that we're doing and introduce you to Jake and Libby.
This year, just to be very clear, the Revels show this year is American, all American, and Appalachia is a big part of the show. And thanks to Jake and Libby, who are our tradition bearers, and they bring a whole side of the story that I feel has not been told enough. However, there's a CD that you can buy of theirs called Pretty Little Mister. They just put that out. They are in the show in the context also of American shape note and shaker music, Southern gospel, and a little Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. So we're covering North, South, East, and West. But without you, we would have no East. So just quickly, I want to say that they also, like Jack, came from different backgrounds. Libby was a classical violinist, maybe still is, and Jake was into funk and metal. And they've both found their way to the music that is in their own DNA, and then they found their way to each other. So what an incredible partnership it is. And it's still pretty young, so we're benefiting from those two being brought together. So without further ado, Jake and Libby, Tui.
For once, the banjo was done first. Well, that first tune was called Old Buck. We learned it from a recording of a guy named Tommy Jarrell, who lived in Toast, North Carolina, and is kind of the godfather of old-time fiddle. He was a major figure in the folk revivalist generation that brought so much of this music down to young people like Libby and myself, because Tommy drove a highway grader for his job. He was in charge of taking care of the highways, but he could not drive. So he would welcome people into his home and teach them tunes in exchange for them driving him around different places. So he very quickly rose to prominence and was such a welcoming figure that a lot of people kind of cottoned onto his style, and some recordings that he made with a frequent musical collaborator by the name of Fred Cockrum kind of set the standard for banjo fiddle duets like ours, so we like to open our shows with one of their tunes. And this next one is called Sugar Babe, and it originally comes from a man named Doc Boggs, who is a coal miner from Wise County, Virginia, which, for those familiar with the geography of Virginia, is the little triangle down at the corner of the big triangle. And he spent most of his life living and working in segregated coal camps there, and would sneak into the black sections of the camp and learn from the musicians that he met there, and kind of developed this really unique, unusual finger style, banjo style that I do not do, so we're gonna do it my way. But the song is called Sugar Babe.
Sugar baby now, I ain't got no honey baby now. and it's all I can say, and it's all I can do. But I can't make a living with you. I can't make a living with you. So I ain't got no sugar, baby, now. Who'll rock the cradle and who'll sing the song? So who'll rock the cradle when I'm gone? Who'll rock the cradle when I'm gone? I'll rock the cradle and I'll sing the song. So I'll rock the cradle when you're gone. I'll rock the cradle when you're gone.
This next one is called Twin Sisters, and we got it from a recording of a fiddler named O.C. Helton, who lived in Asheville, North Carolina. And O.C. was a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, who are some Cherokee folks who managed to stay down there in the mountains in North Carolina after the Indian Removal Act. And he learned to play the fiddle from a formerly enslaved black man who worked in the same distillery as his father. So he's kind of at the intersection of all these things that I like to study. These African and Native American contributions to the music that we play, which is so frequently miscast as this preserved Scottish or Irish or English music, but which changed irrevocably from the moment it arrived on this continent.
One, two, thank you.
listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue Appalachia, a Cultural Crossroads.
Wow, that was amazing. We're going to take questions from the floor now. Anyone who would like to come up, please feel free to ask questions of Jake, Libby, Paddy, Megan. I've got one question. Your own musical influences, how did you shift? What was your own background that you shifted from? Was it funk and soul?
Yeah, you know, there wasn't that much of a shift.
Really?
I don't think of them as being all that different.
Were you playing the banjo in soul and funk?
No, I was playing electric guitar at the time. So that's where I started out. I guess I kind of stumbled into it by accident. I went into this Ethiopian restaurant on U Street in downtown DC, and there was this couple up getting ready to play, and this woman had a washboard and this dude had a banjo, and I was like, well, this is gonna be terrible because I'm from the city and we don't do washboards and banjos there. Little did I know, this band, Megan Jean and the KFB, started playing, and she started singing and everyone's jaw hit the floor, and I was watching this guy play banjo. He was doing this thing I'd never quite seen before. So I went up to him after the show and I was like, what was that? What was that style? Why are you hitting down with your fingernail like that? And he kind of explained to me, oh, that's clawhammer banjo. The banjo originally comes from Africa, and the way that the ancestor instruments are played over there looks a lot more like this than what you may have seen in a bluegrass band, where they're kind of, you know, picking up with all their different fingers.
So. How about you, Libby?
Well, for me, I grew up mostly playing classical music, but when I was sometime in elementary school age, I did take some fiddle lessons with a woman named Sarah Perkle. So I stopped doing that probably when I was like 10 or 11. But then I came back to it from a very different kind of approach when I was, I guess, like 19 or 20. I was a junior in college and I was just feeling really homesick. I was living in Chicago at the time. And so I slowly, actually not so slowly, switched over. And now it's like what I do. It's pretty much my career. I still do a lot of classical stuff, but most of the gigs that I play are in the old-time vein, I would say. Yeah.
Please feel free to come up. Don't feel shy.
So I grew up during that great folk scare you were talking about earlier, and you know, guys like Mike Seeger and his group and a lot of the other folks, they were lucky enough to get a lot of their music directly from the source. I mean, mm-hmm. they could actually play with some of these people. Or how do you think your experience is different getting, I assume, almost all your music at least secondhand or off records or from storytellers? How is that different than the experience of the founding folk revival generation?
Well, first of all, we can explore a lot of different regional styles just from like the comfort of our home in front of our computer now. So what that means is like the way people tend to approach it is that means that they get really detailed about like emulating each style or each fiddler that they hear. Because if you can listen to a fiddler from West Virginia and a fiddler from North Carolina and a fiddler of East Tennessee all next to each other, you start to hear those differences a little bit more clearly because they're like side by side. But beyond like the technical part of things, I would say the biggest difference is less like human relationships with the musicians who you're learning from. And a lot of people do still have mentors, but yeah, I would say that's the biggest difference. You're learning from recordings and you do what you can to learn about who those people were, but you don't have the same connection to those people as human beings or to their communities as folks who go like directly to the source did. So I don't know. There's something to be said for relationships. I think that we tend to separate the music from the people that it came from for that reason a little bit more now.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
And I think that's something a lot of people raise when they're talking about the issues of folks like me, who I'm not from Appalachia. My family is historically related to this musical tradition for sure, but it's not something that's in my immediate community. And the fact that I can go on a website and pull up thousands of recordings of fiddle tunes from these people and learn them without ever going to the place where they lived or meeting anyone that they knew or knowing how they talked or what they thought or how they ate or anything else, really mirrors a lot of the other types of resource extraction that we see going on in Appalachia and the exploitation of the local populace. And one of the things I've grappled with a lot is what to do with the tunes that I don't feel like I have a personal connection to. If I'm playing something from Cooge Bertram, for example, this is someone who is part of the black string band tradition that I know developed largely amongst the slaves in the Chesapeake Bay region from whom I am descended. So I feel a very close personal connection to that, because recordings get you really only so far unless you're incredibly dedicated and incredibly good at listening. And getting to see someone in front of you is a totally different thing on a personal level, and also I think on a musical level.
1, 2, 3, 4.
To Appalachia, a cultural crossroads, an exploration to the roots and history of Appalachian music, in partnership with the Revels and featuring the music of Jake Blunt and Libby Whitenauer. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and First Parish Church in Cambridge. Thanks for joining us, spread the word, and please visit us again.